A redesign is always a daunting prospect for any magazine, especially when its current image is as arresting as Bloomberg Businessweek's. We'll be speaking with that title's editor about its new look today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, hello and welcome to The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up, we chat with Megan Murphy, the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek.
Great journalism is at the very heart of what we do across this organization. It's certainly at the heart of what we do at this magazine. It is under threat like never before.
But before all of that, we start the show with a magazine aimed at the world's ultra wealthy. It's called, appropriately enough, Billionaire, and is distributed to a specially selected pool of 10,000 readers. The magazine is based in Singapore, and as well as catering to the usual interests of the 1%, art, luxury and design, it also has a strong focus on philanthropy. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Billionaire's editor-in-chief, Tara Loder Wilkinson.
Tara, a pleasure to have you here on Monocle 24 on our show about print media, The Stack. First of all, let's go to the basics, Tara. Tell us about, you know, the concept of the magazine and when was it found?
It's a luxury and lifestyle and culture magazine distributed to the world's most influential people. It was launched 5 years ago by David Lepan, who wears many hats, but he's a serial entrepreneur, he's a philanthropist, and a general bon vivant. And he felt that there was a niche in the market for a magazine that truly encapsulated living life to the fullest whilst simultaneously pioneering social responsibility, and also one that was aimed squarely at the world's ultra-high net worth, which is a very demanding and very discerning market. You might have noticed, I know that we sent you a couple of copies, usually before people even open the magazine, they comment on how beautiful it is and how beautifully laid out it is. And that's very important to us. It's very minimalist. There's lots of white space. And it's done with beautiful matte paper instead of glossy. That was a choice we made because we think it's a bit classier. Lots of graphic images. And, of course, the paper is 100% recycled and forestry certified. So it sort of it sits within our core values as well.
Absolutely. It does have an elegant touch to it as well. And you're very much right. As soon as you see the cover, written Billionaire on top with an amazing photography as well. But tell us, you know, of course, the magazine is aimed to the very wealthy. But I guess one of the important things, especially as an editor, is networking as well, because you want to make sure the magazine goes to the hands of the right people as well.
Absolutely. So we distribute this magazine to 10,000 ultra high net worth individuals and families globally, as I say, predominantly in the wealth centers of the US and Europe. And we have that database through a partnership with a former sister company called WealthX. And to that database over the last 5 years, we've built, we've amended, we've expanded. So it's now our proprietary mailing list. And we've expanded it through various partnerships, often with our advertisers, other brands, and actually through our readers who get in touch and tell us, you know, their experience with the magazine and how much they enjoy reading it, which is always really satisfying.
And of course, what differentiates with other magazines that perhaps are also aimed to the very wealthy is the focus on philanthropy as well. So I think that's something that is part of the ethos of your brand as well, right?
Absolutely, yeah, spot on. I mean, I think one of the great things about Billionaire is the caliber of interviews and writers that we can attract. And I think that partly is because of this focus on philanthropy and social enterprise. I mean, for example, we had Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the UN, who wrote a piece for us in a previous issue about the importance of leadership in philanthropy. We recently did an interview with Jimmy Carter, the former US president, about his views on philanthropy. We speak to a lot of billionaire philanthropists about their foundations and their causes. People like Mo Ibrahim, who is championing transparency in Africa. Nikki Oppenheimer, who is very engaged in African Safari Foundation. Bino Chowdhury, Bill Heinecker, all these great individuals, incredibly inspiring, very time poor, but they want to speak to us and get their views out in the magazine, which is fantastic.
I have here in front of me, you know, the Given issue and the Estet issue. Just, a, you know, a simple question. How often does the magazine comes out?
It's quarterly.
It's quarterly. And it's interesting you were mentioning about advertisers. See, I'm here reading the Giving Issue. The first ad is from Embraer, which is, the Brazilian jet as well. So it's a very diverse, very international advertising as well. That's super interesting as well. Can you give us, for example, tell us what's in the latest issue?
Absolutely. So having just gone to print and about to hit the doorsteps of our readers, is the future issue. So that's going to be really interesting read, themed on sort of sub-themes including food security, the future of machines, health, the planet, vehicles, and we've got some really great features and issues in there. For example, a big theme is food security, and that's something which I think is globally concerning at the moment, particularly the problem of livestock agriculture, which is one of the biggest threats facing the planet. So we spoke to a few very interesting Silicon Valley entrepreneurs who are creating these amazing plant-based meat alternatives backed by a whole host of billionaires from Bill Gates to Lee Ka-shing. And the billionaires themselves say, you know, that the products that they're creating are indistinguishable from meat. We've also spoken to, staying with the food theme, some triple Michelin-starred chefs from Paris who, unusually for Parisians, are really championing vegetables and vegetarianism. And on the other end of the scale, we've got a beautiful photo essay of the Arctic, which was shot by our editor at large. And it's absolutely stunning. You know, these vast expanses of white is dotted with these lonely wood cabins. And she actually spoke to some Inuits there about their day-to-day experience of global warming, which is just, it's magic. So I thoroughly recommend, if you can get hold of a copy, then do.
And finally, Tara, I'm just curious, can you tell us where is the magazine and yourself based, and perhaps what are your strongest markets?
Absolutely. Well, our editorial team is small but perfectly formed. I'm based in Hong Kong, but the headquarters is Singapore. And we have editorial and commercial team members all over, dotted around from US, UK, Europe, and we've got a great team of really, really good freelancers. In terms of our readership, the predominant markets are the US and Western Europe. And we also have a Singapore issue with a specific Singapore magazine. So that's the main geographic spread for us.
You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24.
Summer is officially here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. Here we celebrate quality of life and reveal this year's rundown of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. We also meet the people striving to make life in their cities better, from the mayor of Los Angeles to the sunny team that looks after Tokyo's parks and gardens, to the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. Meanwhile, in design, we cast our gaze up to the rooftops in Milan and find a hidden and surprisingly verdant world above the fray. And of course, we've always got room for a bit of pure hedonism as we dance the night away in Tel Aviv, unwind in Finland's most inviting and steamiest company retreats, and tuck into some sun-kissed beach food in Valencia. And speaking of sun-kissed, we also sit down with Mario Testino for his hypothetical last meal. That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
In recent years, Bloomberg Businessweek has jumped out of the business section of magazine stands, breaking completely with the more sober design conventions of the genre. Since 2010, the magazine's exhibited a bold aesthetic, spearheaded by British designer Richard Turley, with something of an ordered chaos of graphs, charts, tables and images superimposed onto the text of its always meticulous reporting. Now the magazine's been redesigned with a cleaner look. And I'm delighted to say that its editor, Megan Murphy, joins us now on the line from New York to talk about what's changed and why. Megan Murphy, thank you very much for joining us on The Stack. Great to have you with us on the programme. Let's talk a little about the redesign, kind of a cleaner look, I guess. Regular readers will notice straight away. Tell us about the process that's gone into recrafting Bloomberg Businessweek.
A lot of changes, both in the print magazine and online. I think when I came aboard in Businessweek right after the election in November, there was a consensus among both at Bloomberg and among the magazine staff that it was time to rethink what we were doing in the magazine, both in terms of look and feel, in terms of tone, in terms of digital reach, and in terms of how we wanted to really prioritize our content and our journalism and really showcase it across platform in a different way. I mean, we have a pretty specific lane, and we want to be the business and finance publication that people rely on, that they turn to, that they're constantly informed and surprised by. And there was a sense that taking the design, stripping it back, making it simpler, cleaner, was a better way to really allow that journalism to shine through. And the other half of the redesign and the relaunch was also getting that consistent premium look and feel across all of our platforms. So that meant, you know, rebuilding both our digital vertical and adding in the app. And we couldn't be more pleased with how the product has come out in the end.
I think that's really interesting, Megan. And it makes me wonder about this idea slightly, of almost a bit going back to the future, if you like, because there's a real emphasis clearly on a clarity of storytelling, a bit more maybe consistency to the design. And I guess maybe that also helps with that idea about a coherent brand message, particularly to your obviously very global audience.
I mean, we can't ignore the times we live in, and we didn't want to have a magazine that felt out of kilter with the times we're living. When we acquired Businessweek, when Bloomberg acquired Businessweek in 2009, it was a very, very different time. And we live in an age right now where we see tremendous tumult on the political, the economic stage, whether it's Brexit, whether it's what's going on in South Korea, whether it's in the U.S. and the current administration and on the unpredictability and the surprising nature. And we believe that people are really craving definitely consistency of thought and theme and presentation. But they also want to go somewhere where they know they're going to get the story behind the story. You know, I hate the term fake news. I'm not afraid to say we want to be an outlet of real news in any shape or form. And I think what we strived for was to create a platform, again, across both print and digitally, that gave you a very clear sense of what we are as a brand, the kinds of stories we tell, and the kind of journalism we want to present. And we feel really lucky to still be doing the kind of long-form investigative pieces, as well as, you know, big interactive graphics, big premium photo spreads. You know, not every magazine can do that. And at Bloomberg, we're really lucky to still be able to do it.
Well, and it's interesting, because I wanted to ask you, and I don't like that rather lazy phrase about fake news or alternative facts, whatever you want to call it. But it's interesting, isn't it, that there seems to be a return, whether it's been prompted by confusion around Brexit or some of the excesses of the Trump administration, a return for readers or consumers of media to brands of authority. We've seen upticks in broadsheet newspaper sales, and there is almost this sense that people are willing to return, and I guess crucially to pay, and often pay more for premium. They want to be, as best they can be, guaranteed about the veracity of the stories. I mean, how do you see Bloomberg Businessweek fitting into that trend, if indeed you also identify that?
I mean, that's a great question, a great point. And there's we absolutely want to be part of that gravitation towards premium. Of course, you know, the business model of Businessweek, we are moving more towards a consumer subscription model. We're not the first, and we won't be the last. You know, the FT has been very successful. The Economist has been successful at transitioning to that model. We see what Jeff Bezos has managed to do with the Washington Post, the New York Times, as people who've really pushed the barriers on this. You know, I've been in this business a long, long time. I grew up in newspapers. And the thing I think that is so at the core of this shift is people have really bifurcated their consumption habits. They use social and TV mainly to get quick, instant hits. But when they want to sit back and when they want to really challenge their mind, challenge ideas, be in receipt of a more sort of leisurely experience and an experience with a product and content, it doesn't matter if it's on your mobile or if it's in a print magazine, they want to have content that's really going to change the way they think, inform the way they think, allow for a better exchange of ideas. They want smart content. And Businessweek, our first and foremost, is about smart, value-added content. We're not in the business of telling you what just happened. You have plenty of places to go for that. We're definitely the place that tells you why it happened, why it matters, and also, crucially, what's going on in places around the world that you just may not know is going on. You may not have been there. You're less familiar with the people, the entrepreneurs, the companies, the products, the trends. We have so many journalists in this organization. We have a better chance than most at actually bringing you face-to-face with those trends, those developments, than some other magazines in the space.
Megan, just leafing back to, I think, the June 19, I've got the European edition of Bloomberg Business Week in front of me, which was, I think, the first sort of introduced the redesign. And I wanted to ask you, looking at some of the features in there, about editorial bravery specifically. There's a fantastic piece, a challenging read, looking at this outsourcing of US chip production back to Asia and some of the impacts that's had. That's a brave editorial choice. And interestingly, amongst that piece, there's a double page spread with just a pull quote, which regular readers of Bloomberg Business Week would say, I don't recognise a page that looks like that. How brave do you personally have to be, whether it's the stories you're commissioning and writing, or whether it's to say, hey, this is a strong story, we can present this in a grown-up way, we don't need all the bells and whistles? Is it every day about being brave, being bold with your decision-making?
That is every day. I mean, that is the responsibility. It is, you know, we're not messing around here. That story you're talking about, Toxic Tech, told the story of women who had potentially been exposed to chemicals during the chip making process that would literally lead to birth defects or their inability to have children for decades after, in fact, it had been shown that these chemicals were potentially hazardous. That is an important story. That narrative, it is actually well known in Korea. In South Korea, it's caused tremendous political issues as well. You know, is something that a lot of people don't know about. And the world we live in now, you know, is so easy in so many respects. That's why we have terms like fake news. You know, we have Uber, we have Airbnb. Almost everything is within the touch of a button on our mobile phone. And frequently what's lost on the side of that is the people along the way. And there's that story and that issue. There's another story in that issue about Western Union and how this company, which a lot of people think about still is changing money, well, actually how they've looked at refugees and the refugee flow from people escaping Syria and migrating, and how they've actually changed their business to be able to service refugees, people who are literally the political punching bags in large portions of America and Europe. This is a business that has actually made it a cornerstone of where they want to go. You know, these are the stories that get lost in global business, and we want to bring them to the forefront. We're, you know, in the redesign, you will see if people, you know, we've doubled down on investigative journalism and long form. We believe these are where you need space length, you need the photography to be able to bring these stories to life. Not, you know, we celebrate success and we want to profile the companies that are changing our world in a positive way, but we also want to show the times when business is not getting it right, and that's a big part of what Business Week is as well.
And I guess perhaps finally, Megan, there's a fundamental question here about the value of great journalism. Now, whether that's about paying people to go and do these stories on the ground, whether it's about ensuring you have the resources to fact check and fact check and fact check again. And this, again, is a narrative that we're perhaps sadly over familiar with on both sides of the pond at the moment. Do you consider it a mantle that weighs heavy? Because I guess people say to you all the time, oh, you know, you're at the front line, you're one of the arbiters of this. Or actually, do you wear it quite lightly? And do you almost relish the idea that you can do your bit to sort of keep great journalism in on the straight and narrow?
I wish I was one of those people who wore that mantle lightly.
But there are some, apparently. I don't know where they are. But
I actually have met a few who I respect tremendously. I believe that great journalism can still change and improve lives. I'm kind of a purist that way. And when I look at some of the stories we've done, from exposing sort of abuses in automobile manufacturing parts industries in the south of America, in southern states in America, or if I look at, you know, this week's issue in global tech and how we're talking about the race for space and the future of a company like Tencent, we are still a force for, I don't want to say a force for good, that sounds too trite. We are a force for information. Business Week doesn't try to make you, I'm not going to tell you how to make up your mind, but I am going to give you the narratives, expose you to the ideas, the people, and you can make up your own mind, but I definitely want to bring you the stories that matter. And I want to bring you the stories that are going to make people think differently. That may be challenging the president, that may be questioning whether Macron can really force through labor reforms in France. It could be a great business story. Great journalism is at the very heart of what we do across this organization. It's certainly at the heart of what we do at this magazine. It is under threat like never before, certainly in my generation. I feel incredibly passionate about protecting it, and I feel even more passionate about letting it shine in the magazine.
Well, more power to you, Megan. It's fantastic to speak with you, and thanks for coming to see us on The Stack. That's Megan Murphy, editor of Bloomberg Business Week. Megan, thanks very much for your time. Finally on the programme, time to talk local press and its continuing relevance. Yesterday, London hosted the London Community Media Summit, where editors of local newspapers, magazines and radio stations gathered to discuss the future of local media and advertising, among other things. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco attended the event and spoke to a couple of the editors about their titles.
So my name is Anna Merrifield. I'm a co-organiser of the London Community Media Summit and I work for the Waltham Forest Echo and the Tottenham Community Press.
Tell us a bit more about the summit, Anna. Is it the first one and what are you aiming with the summit as well?
This is the first summit of its kind in London. It came about quite unexpectedly. We were meeting with other people that were working in community media and we felt like there was really a space for collaboration and support and networking that wasn't really being taken advantage of, and we felt it was really necessary to bring together these small and often independent publications to support each other and facilitate more of a network of support.
And it's very interesting, we're talking here about independent publications, and especially after the tragedy of Grenfell Tower, people are saying that we need actually local press, because at some point people are like, okay, all the papers that were becoming kind of international, talking about, you know, what's happening in the elections in France, but actually sometimes not talking what's happening in their own neighbourhood in some ways.
Absolutely. I think that local journalism has a really big role to play in terms of community cohesion. I think that on a kind of micro level, community journalism is really important for representation and for holding local decision makers to account. And on a larger level, it's really important that we do have independent publications so that there's a diversity of voices and a diversity of news going around and it isn't monopolised.
I would also like, would you discuss in the summit things like perhaps the business model, you know, how those publications can survive as well? Because I know sometimes the market can be quite tough, but perhaps, do you think this will be discussed?
Yeah, so for me it was very important that we did discuss the kind of business and funding side of running a community newspaper or a community media outlet, because often that's the side that receives less attention and it can be the real downfall of an incredible publication with amazing content. They can really struggle if they aren't finding income and you can lose some great assets for the community because the money just isn't there to keep them going.
Perfect. And I know I'll talk to a couple of editors here as well, but you work in some of the papers. Can you just tell us briefly what you do and which papers do you work with?
So I work with the Waltham Forest Echo and the Tottenham Community Press. And with both of those papers, I have a project management role. So I deal with the more logistical sides of keeping them afloat. And that does involve a lot of the business and funding side, which is where I really felt that this conference could be helpful, because I know personally I've really struggled with keeping the papers funded and I feel like there's room for collaboration and support within the network of community media to help each other stay afloat financially.
I'm James Cracknell, I'm editor of Waltham Forest Echo newspaper.
Can you tell us a bit more about the paper, James? Which type of stories do you aim to cover? Do you cover more only things about your local area, or you try to expand a little bit more?
Yeah, obviously as a local paper we cover anything that's going on in Waltham Forest, which is a borough in East London. But anyone living or working in the borough can pitch a story to me, so really it is quite varied. They can write about a national issue or even a global issue and then talk about how it's relevant to Waltham Forest and how it affects them personally. So it is varied actually, yeah.
How important do you think is local press? There's been a very recent tragedy here in London in the Grenfell Tower, and people said, you know, this is where actually local papers should come, you know, and talk about, you know, confront the council in some ways. Do you think that's the role as well of the local press?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously it's important now we need to investigate disasters like that and find out the truth behind what happened and make sure there isn't a cover-up by the authorities, but actually a more important role would be to try to prevent disasters from like that happening in the first place. And that's where local newspapers have a very important role, because who else is going to scrutinize a local authority, a local council? Unfortunately, before Grenfell, there were people, residents in the tower, who were trying to get their voice heard. Unfortunately, there wasn't the right outlet for them to get their voice heard. And that meant that their voice was basically ignored and their pleas weren't heard. So a local newspaper needs to fill that role, and I think particularly community media, by being more open to a variety of voices and by allowing people to actually write articles themselves and submit and pitch articles, it does give you much more freedom to actually cover those sorts of issues, yeah.
I'm Linda Quinn and I edit the community paper for Brixton called The Brixton Bugle and its sister website, The Brixton Blog.
Linda, tell us a bit more, what's the role of the local press? I mean, these days, you know, after what happened at Grenfell Tower, I think everyone is saying that actually this is the role of the local press, you know, to tell about the problems in the council. Do you also believe in that?
Absolutely. I mean, that's key to our mission, is not simply to hold the council account, but to make sure that the local community is aware of the decisions that are being taken in their name. And this has become more important with the demise of traditional local papers, because quite often, for instance, at the planning committee, the community paper, the Brixton Bugle, will be the only media representative there.
That's quite shocking. You're very right. I think sometimes people neglect a little bit local press. Do you have a business model for your paper? Or do you talk to local advertisers? I would like to know more about this.
I wish we had a sustainable business model that would then allow us to employ and train young people to take up the cudgels of community journalism on behalf of their community. However, at the moment, our business model really relies on sponsorship and advertising. And because we're hyper-local, it limits the pool that we can approach for funding. So I guess, in truth, most of our advertisers are actually supporters who give us the money for sponsorship. So our big contributors would be the Business Improvement District, local schools, local estate agents, and what we would like to do longer term is move to a proper community interest company, a co-op where community groups, organisations, businesses become members.
The area of your paper is incredibly vibrant and there's so many like nice events and a lot of culture as well. Is there also a big part of the paper as well?
Oh, it certainly is. I mean, Brixton is buzzing and I guess if we had 100 reporters, we wouldn't be able to really clean the surface of all the amazing things that happen. But we do try. And I guess nearly a quarter of the paper is given over to what's on in Brixton, reviewing local music, local artists. There is always something happening in Brixton.
The Stack's Fernando Augusto Pacheco there, reporting from the London Community Media Summit yesterday. Yeah, and that is all we have time for on this week's programme. Special thanks to our producers Henry, Reese, Sheridan and Fernando, and our editor Cassie Galpin. Comments or queries are welcome. Feel free to further clog up Fernando's inbox. He's on fp@monocle.com and he's always happy to hear from you. You can catch up with us, if you're going to miss us before next week's show, by delving into the archive at the website or on iTunes. This is The Stack. My name's Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.